Hey, we want to welcome you on all our 9 campuses to CCV, wherever you are. We're glad you're here for this third installment of our Dark Horses series. Now, the last couple of weeks, Ashley's been talking about these unlikely heroes, these Cinderella stories of Moses and Gideon. I thought this week we could throw a woman in the mix. This woman actually saved more human lives than any other person in the Bible, male or female. To put it in perspective, if you were to retell her story in the modern world, you'd have to go 1939 Germany. And let's say that there's this teenage girl, beautiful young woman, and Adolf Hitler falls for her head over heels. She doesn't tell him that she's a Jewess. And right when he's ready to pull the trigger on Auschwitz, Kat comes out of the bag, she tells him who he is, and she averts a mass genocide. That would be the story. But it's not 1939, it's 479 BC. And her name is Esther. There's an entire book of the Bible that has her name on it, and I would like for you to find it if you could. Because we're gonna look at her story and pull out 2 major life lessons that will help you become a dark horse hero. 2 big lessons and 4 main characters. We're gonna look at her cousin, Mordecai, who is this faithful Jew that raises Esther, this orphan without mother or father, who becomes the queen of the greatest empire of the world, serving under King Xerxes, and at his right hand is Haman. Those are the 4 characters. There's 2 life lessons, and let me tell you why it matters to me. For all of my life, I can't remember a time that I didn't feel like I had more to offer. I felt like I've always felt like I had more ability than I had opportunity. And if someone out there would just recognize what I had to offer, they would put me in the starting lineup, or I would get the scholarship, or I would get to serve in this kind of organization. As I've grown, I've matured a little bit. And what I've recognized is that I focused on my capacity, not on my character. I'm not proud to admit this, but very often I would want to promote myself. And it wasn't always just about me. I really wanted to make an impact for God. Have any of you felt like that? Have you ever felt like you were meant for more? Like there's more that I could do. There's more that I could be. There's more, if I could just get recognized for my capacity. But it's not about capacity. It's about character. And what I've discovered is that most of the opportunities I've missed is not because someone out there overlooked me, but because I overlooked a need of someone else that I could have served. This is Esther's story, and it begins in chapter 1, verse 1, with the king. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes, who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush, that is Ethiopia in Africa. This guy was an amazing leader. He had over 127 people groups that he had conquered. And it's not just the Bible that talks about him. You can read Xenophon or Herodotus or any of the great historians of that period have to mention Xerxes, because he is, here's his title, King of Kings. He takes the rule from his father in the year 486 BC. His father was the one who lost the battle, unexpectedly, the Battle of Marathon. Sound familiar? He was so mad that he lost that he returned to Persia, bent on revenge. And for the next 4 years, he assembled the greatest army of humanity, not just one nation, but dozens of nations and dozens of languages, hundreds of different weaponries and customs. Getting all that together was an administrative miracle. But then he died, and his son takes over. And for another 3 years, he pulls together the military strategy. So if you can imagine, all the kings and all the generals of all these armies together in the capital for 7 years, working out details. And then it's time to get the boys ready for battle. So they throw a beer bash to end all. In verse 3, it says, "And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all the nobles and the officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present." It is a full buffet, open bar. You know how long? You won't believe this. I'll just read it. For a full 180 days. He displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. And at the end of those 6 months, he opened the palace doors to the population and let the commoners come in to see his wealth and power. For 7 days, they could eat all they want, they could drink all they want. Now, you probably guessed this, but when you get too much testosterone with too much alcohol in the same room, stupid happens. And the stupid was Xerxes, who said, I want my queen Vashti. She's so beautiful. I want her to come in and show off her body to my drunken buddies. He sends her a message to come. She says, no. Rightly so. But it cost her her crown, her position, and her power. She is out. I mean, this dude's got anger management issues. I'm telling you, 3 years later, he finally gets over it. Chapter 2. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Now he's depressed. He didn't have a wife. So the guys around him, the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. This is, it's a beauty contest. Hundreds of virgins, most of them would range from 14 to 17. I know, it's not right. It's also, think about the fantasy suite of The Bachelor. If any of you watch that, don't admit it, please. But this is like night after night after night after night. So they get hundreds of these contestants. They weren't volunteers, by the way. This is an elegant form of human trafficking. This is for the rich and famous. They get all the beautiful virgins from all over the empire to come into this contest. And one of the virgins was a young woman named Esther. She's an orphan. Her parents died, and her cousin, Mordecai, a devout man of God, takes her under his wing. And it says in verse 7, Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, that's her Jewish name, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. The young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure. I mean, see? And was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. And he's coaching her through what must have been a chaotic experience. I mean, you think about the pressure of a 16-year-old Jew in Persia being thrown into this sexually charged frenzy of an ordeal. Now, the preparations for a young woman, she is lovely, preparations for her would be 12 full months. Now, some of you guys complain about your wife spending too much time at the bathroom. Stop it, it's for you. But hers is 12 months. 6 months were for lotions, potions, and ointments, and the other was for perfumes and other kinds of makeup. Seems excessive to me. During that 12 months, Xerxes is actually out of town. And I want to put down the Bible for a minute and pick up Herodotus, that great historian who has literally 100 times more to say about Xerxes than the Bible does. Now, I'm going to pare it down to just 2 critical incidents that might be familiar to you. He goes to the shores of Greece to wreak vengeance on those upstarts who destroyed his father at the Battle of Marathon. 10 years later, he's now back with an army. Herodotus says was a 1,000,000-man army. He exaggerates. It was probably more like 250,000, but still, no nation had ever seen that many soldiers brought together in one place in history. He was a phenom. And he gets to the gates of Thermopylae. The mountains come and meet the shores, and it's a narrow passageway. You can't get a whole bunch of guys through there at a time. He's got 250,000, and standing in his way are 300 Spartans. Yeah, sound familiar? That's that great 2007 blockbuster movie. It comes straight out of Herodotus. These Spartans, fighting for their nation and fighting for their lives, stay off a 250,000 man army for 3 days. And it would have been longer if some Greek hadn't betrayed his nation and given Xerxes the secret goat path to get behind the troops of the Spartans through the mountains. That's why they fell so soon. Xerxes is furious for the delay. And when he descends on Athens, he spares no mercy. Destroys the houses, destroys the temples. He even goes up on the Acropolis. Maybe you've seen pictures of Athens. All of those temples that are there now were rebuilds from after Xerxes. He leveled it. But not before the citizens of Athens could escape. Those 3 days were critical for saving the nation. And they escaped to an island. It was just off the coast. It's called Salamis. In fact, you can see it from the Acropolis. So all the people are on Salamis. Xerxes can't get to them. So it becomes not a land battle, but a naval battle, which is no problem for Xerxes. He has 4 times the number of ships. And his ships are better. So are his sailors. Except for the Greeks lured all his ships into the very narrow passage between Salamis and the mainland. And there, with Xerxes watching from the Acropolis, they picked them off one at a time. They sunk or captured every single ship. And you don't know maybe how important this is to you. Western civilization, as we know it, was hanging in the balance. If Xerxes won, there would be no Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, Alexander the Great, or Greek New Testament. But God's sovereign hand is in this, and he has to go home, tail between his legs, and mad as a hornet. His only consolation prize are hundreds of virgins waiting for him in the fantasy suite. When it comes time for Hadassah, or Esther, to go in, listen to how it's described in verse 13. This is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. So I'm assuming like special clothes, jewelry, perfumes, maybe some servants. Whatever would make her look good, she could take. In the evening, she would go there, and in the morning return to another part of the harem in the care of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. I want you to imagine for a moment that you're a 16-year-old girl. Now, I could be off by a year, up or down, but she's a teenager. She's a virgin. The king is about 40 years old, and he's very much not a virgin. He's Persian. She's Jewish. He's wealthy. She's a pauper. She's an orphan. He's a king. How incomparable is this? The intimidation factor would be enormous. And that brings me to the first rule of dark horse wins. From the book of Esther, rule number one, all champions play injured. Why does that matter? Because sometimes when I read a story like Esther, or Moses, or Gideon, I say, well, of course, God gave them the victory. God gave them the power. God gave them the position. And I'm sitting here feeling like I'm being overlooked. I have more ability than I have opportunity. If I were in their shoes, I could win. Not true. Everybody plays injured. Everybody has disadvantages. You do, I do, we all do. But the difference between a dark horse who wins and the rest of us is the dark horse refuses to make their disadvantage an excuse. Excuses are kryptonite for a dark horse victory. She stood strong in spite of the intimidation, and she did what she could with what she had, and that's what makes winners. So how can you take this to work next week? I mean, how can you transport this idea? And it's pretty cool. Whether you're a Christian, a pre-Christian, a pro-Christian, a post-Christian, all of you can apply this in one simple way. When you go to work, focus on your character, more than your capacities. See, I have been under the impression much of my life, in my immaturity, I'll admit that, I've been under the impression that if I just had the capacity, I should be given the opportunity. But every leader knows that your capacity is secondary to your character. I can teach you capacity far quicker than I can teach you character. And it wasn't that the leaders were overlooking my capacities, I was overlooking my lack of character. And because of that, I was overlooking the opportunities to serve others rather than promoting myself. Watch the character of Esther at play. Verse 15. When the turn came for Esther to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Hegal, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. Here's what's going on. Most of the girls who go into the king, I would assume, would want to doctor themselves up, maybe prop themselves up artificially, make them more beautiful, to smell better, to have a higher hairdo, a fancier dress. Esther was wise enough to know that a 16-year-old girl doesn't know what a 40-year-old king wants in the bedroom. So she asks. She goes to Haggai and says, I'm new to this. I don't know what I'm doing here. Can you coach me on what the king might like? And as you can guess, 40-year-old men may want something totally different than a 16-year-old would assume. And he goes with just what the king would want. See, here's the difference between dark horse winners and the rest of us. Instead of looking at how they can promote themselves, they look at how they can serve someone else. Instead of creating an opportunity, they capture an opportunity. And that leads to the second rule of dark horses. I'm just going to quote Jesus on this one. Be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. Now, we get the innocent part down, right? As Christians, we know how to live morally and serve humbly. We get that. But shrewd as snakes, really? Jesus said that? Yeah, he did. See, we think that shrewd is rude. It is not. Innocence is not enough to survive when you are a sheep among wolves. You need to be shrewd. And Esther is shrewd, not because she's smart, but because she is brave enough to ask what she does not know. Most of my life, the reason I've missed opportunities is because I was so intent on presenting myself as accomplished that I was too embarrassed to ask the questions that would really help. I was afraid of looking foolish. But you can't get wisdom unless you get it from someone who's wiser than you. So how do you take this to work next week? All of you can. Again, I'm just going to quote a verse. The beginning of wisdom is this: get wisdom. Though it cost all you have, get understanding. You see, Hadassah, or Esther, she asked Haggai what to take into the king's chamber. She submitted to Mordecai, her cousin, when he said, don't tell him that you're a Jew. Hold that card close until you have to play it. He was shrewd. In fact, I'll tell you how shrewd Mordecai is. Before the chapter is over, he's in the palace caring for Esther, doing what he can to make her comfortable and give her advice. He's just standing there, and around the corner, he overhears two guards talking. They hated Xerxes, and they were plotting to kill him. And instead of going directly to the king, and he gets the win, he gave the information to Esther and let her get the win. She saved her king's life. That was a brilliant tactic. And then we get to chapter 3, and this is where things just get a little crazy. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all other nobles. Let me introduce you to our friend Haman. Haman is an Agagite. Let me explain what that means. If you go back in the Bible to the very first king of Israel, his name's Saul, one of the kings that he conquered and killed was Agag. This guy is a descendant of Agag. He and his family have held a grudge against the Jews for 500 years. He hates all the Jews. And you know who he hated worse than anybody else? Mordecai. Why? Because when he walked out of the palace, he presented himself like a god. And all the people literally bowed down before him, except for one dude, Mordecai. Mordecai's going, I'm not bowing before you. You're not, I'll bow before Yahweh. You're not Yahweh. I'm not bowing before you. So Haman began to plot against his life. It took him 4 years to figure out the plot. He couldn't just kill Mordecai, but he could kill all the Jews in all the provinces. And he goes to Xerxes and says, hey, Xerxes, you got these people, the Jews. They're not really fans of yours. In fact, they're very dangerous, and we should probably kill them all. And Xerxes says, yeah, do what you think is right. He actually offered to pay for the pogrom out of his own pocket. The Bible says it was 10,000 talents of silver. I did the math. You know how much that is in today's economy? $171 million. This dude hates Jews. But he can't just kill the Jews, even with the king's permission. He needs the permission of the gods. So like many of the leaders of his day, kind of mystical, they would cast lots to find the propitious time, the right time. And the dice fell on month 12, day 13. That gives Mordecai 11 months to live. When the announcement was made to all the provinces that the Jews are going to die in 11 months, Mordecai sends a message to Esther. She's in the palace, insulated from all of the outside news. She doesn't know that her people are in danger. And Mordecai says to her, you've got to go to Xerxes. Plead with Xerxes for the life of your people. And Esther says, I can't do that. It was literally against the law for Esther, even the queen, to go into the king's chambers without being invited. And if she did, she would die. Unless he raised his scepter, then she could live. But the king hadn't called Esther in for 30 days. He's got a lot of other concubines. She's just the queen. And so Mordecai says, you got to go in. She says, I can't. Listen to what Mordecai says to young Esther. This is brilliant. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. Mordecai was right. God will do what God will do. And if he wants to save the Jews, he's going to save the Jews with or without you. Your choice right here, right now. You, me, we have a choice to do it God's way or get out of the way. But God's will be done. And if you think that you're going to save your own life by not doing what God asks you to do, you are sadly mistaken, Mordecai says. And Esther, this is a powerful word to her from her uncle. And this is the core of the entire book. Listen. And who knows, but you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. I'm not talking about Esther, I'm talking about you. Why do you think God gave you the job he gave you? It's not because he loves you, it's because somebody else has a need. Oh, he loves you, don't get me wrong, but that's not why you have your job. That's not why you have your house, your wife, your family, your career, your abilities. Everything God has given you, he has given you for the purpose of standing in the gap because somebody needs what you have, what you hold. It's not for you to promote your capabilities. It's for you to serve and have the character of God and the heart of him for people who are endangered. And you look around our nation today, we are in troubled times. And if somebody doesn't stand and stand in the gap in their school, at their work, at their family, there will be consequences for you and for those that you refuse to serve. So Esther says to Mordecai, have all the Jews pray for me and fast for 3 days. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. If you're not willing to lay down everything, you're not ready to stand for anything. Esther is a noble woman. It's not her capacities that made her a winner. It was her character. She goes to the king, and sure enough, he raises his scepter. She's going to live. And he says, oh, my queen, what is it that you request? I will give you whatever you ask, up to half of my kingdom. And she says, king, this is what I request. Come to dinner with me tonight. Bring Haman along, and I'll tell you what my request is. They come to dinner. Haman's there. Xerxes is there. Esther's there. And the king says, what is it that you want? Whatever you ask, I'll give it to you, up to half of my kingdom. And she said, come tomorrow night, and I'll tell you tomorrow night what I want. She's not being coy. There was something in the moment that was not right. And you see this young woman, because of her mentor Mordecai, is beginning to have the wisdom. Timing has to be right. The words have to be right. The heart has to be right. And she had no idea exactly what was causing all this, but you'll see in a moment why. Haman goes home that night. He's on cloud nine. I mean, he doesn't just get one personal dinner with the king and queen, but two days in a row. And he is just flying high until he walks by Mordecai. Mordecai would not bow, and it just sent him to the moon. He was so angry, and he stomps in the house and slams the door, and he bursts out to his wife and his family. This should be the greatest day of my life, but I can't stand it because Mordecai won't bow. And they said, well, kill him. I mean, you're the king's right-hand man. Build some gallows 75 feet high. And tomorrow, go to the king and ask him to hang Mordecai in a gallows. He's going to do what you ask. You know he's going to do what you ask. He says, yeah, I'll do it. In the morning, he was the first person at the palace. Little did he know that Xerxes had spent the night awake all night, insomnia. And when a king has insomnia, he calls a servant to come read the royal annals. That will put anyone to sleep. But the scroll that he picked, by chance, was the story of Mordecai informing Esther about the two soldiers who were going to assassinate him. By the way, Xerxes actually does die by assassination from two bodyguards. This is real. Then he said, what was done for Mordecai? Nothing. Well, that's not right. We got to do something for Mordecai. In walks Haman. He goes, Haman, hey, so glad you're here. I want to ask you a question. Haman, what should we do for a man that the king wants to honor? And Haman is going, who would the king want to honor more than me? He said, I'll tell you what I would do if I were your king. I would get your own stallion and put that man on the stallion and take your own royal robe and put it on him, put your crown on his head and have someone parade him through all of the city of Susa because you want everybody to know that he is your favorite. And Xerxes said, that's a great idea. Do that for Mordecai. He was mortified. The rest of the day, he's dragging Mordecai through the city on a stallion of the king. It was a horrible day, but a good night because he still has dinner with the king and queen. And you get to the banquet, and the king said, all right, Esther, out with it. What do you want? She says, king, I want you to spare my life and spare the life of my people. Because we're being threatened. Who dare threaten the king of the or the queen of the great Xerxes? That man, right there. Xerxes was so furious, he had to leave the room. Haman is just scared to death, and he lunges at the couch where Esther was dining, and he grabs a hold of her, and he pleads with his wife. At that very moment, the king comes back in and sees him manhandling his wife. How dare you attack my wife in my own room? And he had Haman hanged on the gallows he made for Mordecai. And a new decree went out that on the 12th month, the 13th day, all the Jews could defend themselves. And they did. And that day has been remembered every single year in every single synagogue all over the world. It is called the Feast of Purim. Purim is the Hebrew word that means to cast lots. Haman cast the lots and they fell back on him. How is Esther a dark horse victor? For one reason. Do you realize that in this entire book of Esther, the name of God is never mentioned once? And then, well, why is it even in the Bible? Because it's a message for us that when you can't hear God, you would better see God. And he's everywhere. He's when Haman built the gallows. He's when Mordecai overheard the plot. He's when Esther was chosen. God is everywhere, and he's everywhere in your life as well. And if you don't see God, you will continue to promote your capacity and ignore your character and miss the moments that God has chosen for you for such a time as this. There is a gap that you fit perfectly into. Somebody needs you to know about God, to have their life saved and their heart healed. Somebody needs you to coach them and mentor them and serve them. As Ashley said last week, we have literally thousands of serving opportunities all over our campuses, but whether it's here or in your business or at home or at school or at work, God is calling you. And some of you know that you have been putting this off for years, that aching in your heart that you could be more. You should be more. And it begins by service. And if you don't have the character to serve, you'll never have the capacity to lead. We have a great church in a great city with great needs. God is calling us to stand in the gap and represent Jesus Christ. Let's be his hands and feet this week. Holy Father, what a phenomenal story. I want this to be my story. I want this to be our story. So would you give us the courage to take the step into the throne room and to stand in the gap for people who cannot speak for themselves? Would you help us see you even when we cannot hear you? We pray in the powerful name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Let's go out and make Jesus famous.